inevitably Japan, serious political capital. And it begged the question, if there was no grand regional alliance, where did that leave Obama and Clinton's pivot to Asia and the de facto policy of containing China? Indeed, abandoning TPP and TTIP was not just a break with the Obama era, it was a reversal of America's sponsorship of multilateral trade policy dating back to the 1940s. At the first G20 meeting attended by Treasury Secretary Mnuchin in Baden-Baden in March 2017, it was impossible to reach agreement even on a simple pledge to resist all forms of protectionism. As Wolfgang Schäuble noted in his usual uncompromising fashion, the meeting had reached an impasse. All Mnuchin had to offer by way of clarification was that the new administration had a different view on trade. Philip Hammond, the UK Chancellor, advised his colleagues that it was better to give the Trump administration more time. If we demand a hard answer now, I'm pretty sure we won't like the answer we get. Meanwhile, in Washington, a battle was raging over NAFTA. As far as Trump was concerned, it was one of the worst deals ever. As he told journalists after 3 months in office, he was really ready and psyched to terminate it. The relish was obvious. Bannon and economic adviser Peter Navarro, a nationalist trade economist, urged him to follow his instincts. For the announcement, they had earmarked a rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, on April 29, 2017, to celebrate his first 100 days in office. For Mexico and Canada, it would have been a brutal blow. Realizing the seriousness of the situation, they rapidly coordinated their positions. Desperate to prevent a precipitate break, hundreds of American business leaders lobbied the White House. The Secretary for Agriculture, the Commerce Secretary, and the Secretary of State all pleaded for a stay of execution. In the end, the decisive argument appears to have been a map, showing quite how much of Trump country would be hurt by withdrawal. Did the President really want to put Texas in play? The map shows that I do have a very big farmer base, which is good, Trump later told journalists. They like Trump, but I like them, and I'm going to help them. That meant not cancelling NAFTA. Instead, Washington would renegotiate. But it would do so from a weakened position. The Obama administration had spent years haggling for improved access to Canadian agricultural markets, cross-border licensing of financial services, and improved labor standards with Mexico. To do so, it had used not raw threats, but the lure of the even bigger trade deal, TPP. A project into which the United States had inveigled Mexico and Canada at the Los Cabos G20 summit in 2012. With TPP gone, all the concessions on NAFTA already agreed were consigned to the dustbin of history. Trump's renegotiation would start from scratch, with little but threats to offer. NAFTA, TPP, TTIP were regional treaties. The truly global forum for trade policy was the WTO. It was an original creation of the founding moment of American globalism in the 1940s. The United States had long been its most powerful backer. President Trump did not attend the party to celebrate the 70th anniversary of its founding in November 2017 at the Ronald Reagan Building in Washington, D.C., but he sent his ill wishes by way of Fox News. The WTO was set up for the benefit of everybody but us. They have taken advantage of this country like you wouldn't believe, he told the news channel. As his trade representative, Trump appointed the veteran trade warrior Robert Lighthizer, who in the 1980s had been responsible for extracting the agreements by America's major competitors to voluntarily restrain their steel exports to the United States. Lighthizer blasted the WTO with a broadside. He objected to the judicial activism of the WTO's trade arbitration panel, its pandering to the special pleading of large developing countries like India, its failure to address areas of chronic industrial overcapacity, such as steel, and above all, its inability to get to grips with the unprecedented challenge to economic liberalism posed by the rise of Chinese state capitalism. In Washington's view, the WTO should confine itself to providing a forum for bargaining between the major trading powers. The United States should throw off any restraint on its ability to retaliate against economies that it considered to be discriminating against it. But rather than translating this vision into positive proposals for the WTO, the Trump administration adopted the tactics the Republicans had used to such effect in Congress. The United States refused to permit the appointment of new arbitrators to WTO panels, threatening to hollow out the institution, making it increasingly dysfunctional and illegitimate. If there was no actual éclat at the WTO meeting in December 2017, the lack of progress on any area of trade liberalization was dismal. Lighthizer did not even deign to stay until the end of the conference. The shock delivered by the new administration to global economic institutions was severe. There had been nothing like this since the 1930s, and nowhere was this felt more acutely than in Europe. In the early days, it was unclear whether the Trump team actually acknowledged the EU as a counterparty, or understood that the United States no longer maintained bilateral trade relations with individual European countries. In an interview given just days before he took office, Trump dismissed the EU as a vehicle for Germany. According to inside sources, members of his entourage were placing phone calls to European leaders to ascertain which countries might be leaving next. Trump's people believed the Brexit hype. There was a fear in Europe that Trumpery would spread. London was about to trigger Article 50 and formal exit proceedings. The Austrian, Dutch, and French elections were all in play. There were forces in the White House that openly supported not only Brexit, but Marine Le Pen and the Front. Once the initial shock wore off, international forces began to concert themselves. Mexico and Canada worked together closely to do what was possible to save NAFTA. The other parties to TPP decided to go ahead without the United States. By late May, when Trump made his first visit to Europe, the populist spook had passed. Macron was in the saddle in Paris. When the American president refused publicly to underline America's commitment to Article 5 of the NATO treaty and gave notice of his intention to withdraw from the Paris Climate Change Agreement, Merkel had seen enough. Germany was in general election mode, and the spectacular swing in European public opinion against Trump gave Merkel every reason to act. On May 28, 2017, the day after Trump's departure, speaking to an enthusiastic crowd in Munich, the German Chancellor announced that Europe had to adjust to a new reality. After Trump and Brexit, it was clear that Europe could no longer rely completely on its long-standing American and British allies. The times in which we can fully count on others are somewhat over, as I have experienced in the past few days. We Europeans must really take our destiny in our own hands. Of course, we need to have friendly relations with the US and with the UK, and with other neighbours, including Russia, but we have to fight for our own future ourselves. It was no doubt a remarkable moment. As Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations, tweeted, "Merkel saying Europe cannot rely on others and needs to take matters into its own hands is a watershed, and what US has sought to avoid since World War II. But what did it actually amount to? Europe's own process of consolidation in the wake of the crisis seemed stalled. President Macron of France offered a bold vision of Europe's future in a major speech at the Sorbonne. But who was it addressed to? After the inconclusive elections in Germany in September 2017, there was only a caretaker government in Berlin. Italy was creaking under the weight of years of recession. Spain was thrown into chaos by Catalonia's bid for independence. Furthermore, any moves toward further integration and self-determination for the continent were bound to arouse resistance. If Britain was leaving, the difficult Eastern Europeans remained. In July 2017, on his second trip to Europe for the G20 meeting in Hamburg, Trump made a point of stopping in Poland. In front of a crowd of supporters of the Law and Justice government, Trump found a European audience that loved him. The flags waved as he proclaimed America's commitment to NATO as a bulwark of civilization and a bastion for the people of the West who still cry out, "We want God." Trump had segued from America First to a clash of civilizations. But neither one nor the other would go down well with a multicultural crowd that was awaiting America at the G20 meeting. As Hammond, the British Chancellor, had pointed out, sometimes it was better not to push the Trump administration too hard for a clarification of its position. There was reason to fear that one might not like the answer. Clearly, Merkel's vision of a united Europe fighting for its own future would have to tackle deep internal divisions. Nor was the rise of right-wing nationalism Europe's only point of difference. Trump's protectionism was directed not just against Asian competitors. Germany, too, was in the crosshairs. As ever, Finance Minister Schäuble was quick to respond. He would no more take criticism from Trump and Mnuchin than he had from Obama, Geithner, the IMF, or fellow Europeans. In the German view, a trade surplus was first and foremost a reward for export competitiveness, but the kind of gigantic deficit run by the United States also pointed to deeper macroeconomic imbalances. It was hardly surprising that given Germany's budget surplus and America's large and growing government deficit, there should be a difference in their trade accounts. This was the familiar repertoire of arguments about transatlantic trade. But this time Schäuble added a twist. It was true, he admitted, that German exports enjoyed a competitive advantage. The euro was undervalued. But it was not Germany that set interest rates or the value of the euro. It was the ECB. To the horror of German savers, Mario Draghi's expansive policy of QE was driving European bond yields into negative territory and depressing the value of the euro. Visiting Washington in April 2017, Schäuble told American audiences that he had warned Draghi about the tendency of the ECB's expansive monetary policy to inflate Germany's trade surplus. That it was causing tension with the United States was predictable. The ECB stood firm, and the IMF backed the continuation of QE in Europe. But Schäuble had served notice of how Trump's attacks might be instrumentalized in the long-running argument over Eurozone economic policy. The furor around Trump should not cause one to forget how bitterly Europeans and Americans had squabbled over economic policy in the good Obama years. The ECB's belated monetary expansion at a time of Fed tightening was a real source of transatlantic imbalance, and it was a reminder of the disharmony of a monetary policy that had marked the world economy since the onset of the crisis, a disharmony to which conservative voices in Germany had contributed as much as anyone. Nor were the chronic surpluses of Germany, the Netherlands, and China figments of a Trumpian imagination. They pointed to real and persistent imbalances in the world economy. In global trade policy, as in so many other areas, the outrage caused by the uncouth belligerence of the Trump administration too easily obscured the reality of the problems it was gesturing toward. At the G20, the atmosphere was self-congratulatory. The WTO earned applause for seeing the world economy through the financial crisis of 2008 far better than it had fared during the Great Depression of the 1930s. There had been no catastrophic lurch toward high tariffs and protectionism. There had been no repeat of the Smoot-Hawley tariff of 1930. The 21st century system of global governments might not be popular, but it had worked, or so the story went. 10 years on from the crisis, it was therefore the height of populist irresponsibility to indulge in backbiting economic nationalism. For the defenders of the status quo, Trump made a perfect caricature enemy against whom to reassert the nostrums of liberalism. But this deflected attention from a more complex and ambiguous reality. The idea that Trump constituted a sudden and shocking break with a prevailing liberal success story depends on an unduly sanguine view of the global backdrop. This was as true with regard to trade as it was with regard to monetary policy. In fact, the last major effort to negotiate a global trade deal, the Doha Round, had come to a crashing halt in the summer of 2008. World trade had recovered from the disaster of 2008 to 2009, but since 2010, trade volumes had stagnated. In 2015, they had declined. This was driven in part by the business cycle. The taper tantrum and the setback to commodity prices had rocked the emerging markets, but it also reflected a wave of protectionist measures adopted by countries across the world, concentrated not on tariffs, but on a variety of non-tariff barriers. No one imagined that Trump's personal views on trade reflected arcane knowledge of new types of protectionism. He was regurgitating opinions first formed in the 1970s and 1980s. But if the expert staff around Lighthizer was looking for ammunition to demonstrate the reality of discrimination against U.S. exports, it was ready to hand. Through tax breaks, subsidies, and export credit systems, not to mention China's state capitalism, world trade was increasingly shaped not only by corporate value chains, but also by state intervention. A large part of America's huge trade deficit was accounted for not only by Chinese trade discrimination, but also by lost export earnings siphoned through offshore tax havens, located not only in the Caribbean, but also in the EU. In this respect, too, the once robust assumption that globalization was an inevitable, natural process was losing its power to convince. Trump's trade hawks did not advocate a return to the 1930s, but neither were they willing to continue the pretense that the naive triumphalism of 1989, with its easy assumptions about the inevitable victory of democratic capitalism, any longer jived with the facts. As the National Security Strategy issued in December 2017 darkly declared, "There is no arc of history that ensures that America's free political and economic system will automatically prevail." Such talk was no doubt supposed to suggest a profound realist wisdom, but it was in fact symptomatic less of a bold or coherent new world view than of the rather desperate mood in Washington. It was particularly rich coming from an administration whose supporters in Congress had, in the name of God-given American values, repeatedly tried to sabotage crisis-fighting efforts, and who now demanded that the Fed should ensure the best of all possible worlds by following a non-discretionary, automatic policy rule. The arc of history, sonorously rejected by Trump's security hawks, had, of course, been invoked by President Obama. But in using that figure of speech, he had referenced not deterministic neoconservative philosophies of history, but the prophetic voice of one of America's greatest freedom struggles. There was indeed no determinacy. The question was how the arc might be beat. Even if one accepted some version of the disillusioned narrative of the world economy offered by the Trump camp, the question was how to respond. Was America First an adequate answer, even for America? Whatever the answer to that question, the reality that the rest of the world had to deal with was that the American electorate had put in office an erratic, narcissistic nationalist who no longer offered any commitment to upholding an international order unless it directly and immediately connected to American national interests, however those were defined. Given the size and reach of the American nation state and its economy, this had profound global consequences. In 2008, the United States had been at the epicenter of the crisis. Both the Bush and Obama administrations had faced the hard fact that there was little or nothing that was automatic about the functioning of the global financial system. It had taken unprecedented efforts, led by the United States and the rest of the G20, to stabilize both America's free political and economic system and the world economy. In 2017, the United States was once again at the center of global concern. But this time it was uncertainty emanating from America's erratic new government that was the key. And once it was framed that way, the question that Paulson had put in the summer of 2016 could not be dodged. How might the United States fare in a future financial crisis under President Trump? Would he be able to rally a concerted response? If the haggling over the debt ceiling in 2017 was anything to go by, it would again come down to a bargain between pragmatic centrist Republicans and congressional Democrats. Of course, we can peer only dimly into the future. So what might we learn by looking to the past? If there is a question that may throw light on our future prospects, it is not how Trump might have coped in 2008, or how he may cope with some future contingency, but why in 2017, when he took office, Trump did not face a global economic implosion? It may seem like a perverse question. In 2017, economic growth in the United States was steady, unemployment was down to pre-crisis levels, the markets were booming. In Europe, the economy was finally bouncing back. An immediate crisis was not in the cards. The real force of the question becomes apparent if we direct our attention, in conclusion, not to America and Europe, the old hub of transatlantic globalization, but to China and the emerging markets, where the future of the world economy will be decided. There, the years prior to 2017 had been anything but calm. Chapter 25. The Shape of Things to Come. On January 17, 2017, as the World Economic Forum assembled at Davos to consider the implications of Brexit and Trump, China's President Xi Jinping stepped to the rostrum to deliver the opening plenary. It was a speech widely seen as announcing China's new role as an anchor of globalization. 8 years earlier, the governor of PBOC had made headlines around the world by proposing a new Bretton Woods. That intervention staked China's claim to be a major voice in global economic governance. In 2017, Xi no longer needed to break down the door. All he had to do was to declaim the most basic platitudes of what had once been the global consensus, reinforcing them with a bracing dose of historical materialism, a few ancient proverbs, and a reassuring recitation of China's mind-blowing growth record. It was exactly the message that the CEOs, investors, and policy experts at Davos wanted to hear, and Xi was exactly the person to deliver it. Unlike Trump, he was clearly a sophisticated individual. He might head a communist party, but as a princeling, he had the reassuring air of someone born to power. Unlike Angela Merkel, she did not need to convince anyone of his capacity and will to act on a scale commensurate with China's place in global affairs. His evident authority demonstrated China's arrival not just as a major economy, but as a superpower. For many across the world, particularly in Europe, China was already the economic superpower. Amid the awed sense of a historic transition, memories were short. It was easily forgotten that at Davos only a year earlier, the talk had been not of Chinese hegemony, but of China's economy unleashing a global disaster. The emerging market economies had been in trouble since the taper tantrum of 2013. Two of the great economic success stories of the new millennium, Brazil and South Africa, had crash-landed. The commodity price collapse in the fall of 2014 dealt a heavy blow to exporters of oil, gas, iron ore, and other raw materials. Russia and much of Central Asia were struggling under the impact of sanctions and the Ukraine crisis. Given lackluster growth in Europe and the United States, the one sustaining force in the world economy was China's relentless growth. And in 2015, even that suddenly seemed in doubt. On June 12, 2015, while the West was distracted by events in Greece and Ukraine, China's stock market began to slide. From a high of 5,166, in 3 weeks, the Shanghai Composite Index plunged 30%. With a state-directed national team of investors, companies, and funds pumping billions of yuan into the market, stock prices temporarily stabilized. But in mid-August, amid fears of a yuan devaluation, the market fell again and reached a new low just above 3,000 in September. From that plateau, government intervention temporarily pushed it higher. But on January 4, 2016, the collapse resumed. By February, further waves of selling took the index down to 2,737, not much more than half of its level 6 months earlier. For the regime, it was deeply embarrassing. In 2013, Xi had launched his new administration on the promise of the China Dream. Unwisely, party propaganda outlets had tied this directly to the fortunes of the stock market. Hundreds of millions of Chinese had entrusted their savings to the market. Those investments were now collapsing, just as the regime was gearing up for massive anniversary commemorations to mark the victory over Japan in 1945. The September 3rd Victory Day parade was to be a monumental event, making good on the incantation, "Never forget national humiliation," and answering with the celebration of victory. Putin was the guest of honour. It was fitting that, at the same time, the yuan was gaining recognition as an international currency. In the fall of 2015, the IMF was on the point of including China's currency in its SDR benchmark. A condition of being included in the IMF basket was that Beijing should allow the yuan to move more freely. For decades, the yuan had been a one-way bet. Against the overvalued dollar, the only way was up. But when in early August 2015, Beijing liberalized currency trading, the yuan promptly plunged. Clearly, something was very wrong, and unlike in 2008, it was clear that the source of trouble was inside China. In years of explosive growth, supercharged since 2008 by a massive surge in credit, Chinese heavy industry had built up huge overcapacity. The real estate sector was weighed down by overbuilding. The stock market had been pumped up by irrational exuberance and a wave of dangerous margin lending. China had an overinflated shadow banking sector, horribly reminiscent of that which had come crashing down in Europe and America in 2007 to 2008. But what worried the observers studying the Chinese scene most acutely was the huge wave of money that was exiting China at the rate of hundreds of billions of dollars per month in search of safe haven. Did they know something that the rest of the world did not? For 20 years, the undervaluation of the yuan had been a constant in world economic affairs. Now it seemed the tables were turned. Was China about to become just another emerging market boom gone bad, albeit the largest the world had ever seen? It was a terrifying thought, and it begged a question. How could a country with a strong trade balance and huge reserves be sliding toward a currency crisis? It was eerily reminiscent of 2008, when champion exporters like South Korea and Russia had found their banks in trouble and struggling desperately for dollar funding. And the explanation was the same in 2015 as it was in 2008. Globalization operated through different channels at different levels. The visible trade channel on which countries like South Korea and China were so dominant was only one and not the most decisive channel for a financial crisis. An economy with a strong trade surplus, ample foreign currency reserves, and an appreciating currency might well have banks, corporations, and private citizens accumulating debts in foreign currencies. The need for dollar funding had been the common denominator of the South Korean, the Russian, and the European banks in 2008. It made them acutely vulnerable to a shift in interest rate differentials or a reversal in the direction of exchange rate movements. It wasn't the balance of trade, but their corporate balance sheets that made them vulnerable. In 2008, China had not yet been fully incorporated into this logic. Its globalization was still classic, dominated by its trade account. It was precisely this familiar quality of China's development and its counterpart in America's twin deficits that distracted Western analysts from the massive financial tensions building up in North Atlantic balance sheets. But since 2008, as China's breakneck modernization continued, it had become ever more integrated in financial terms. The commercial logic driving China's financial integration was compelling. Chinese businesses were investing like none had ever invested before. Interest rates in China were low, but thanks to Bernanke's QE, they were even lower in the dollar world. The only likely movement in the yuan was upward. Put the two together and you had the ingredients for a profitable carry trade. Borrow in dollars, invest in yuan, repay the dollar loan from the proceeds of the booming Chinese economy at an appreciating yuan exchange rate. If China's exchange regulations made it difficult to import US dollars directly, one or two further steps were added. Borrow in dollars, buy commodities, use the expected receipts from the sale of the commodities as collateral to borrow in yuan, invest the yuan in China. Profit could be made three ways: on the spread between Chinese returns and dollar funding costs, on the depreciation of the dollar against the yuan, and on the likely increase in the value of the commodities driven upward by booming Chinese demand. According to BIS estimates, by the end of 2014, while China's official reserves reached $4 trillion at their peak, Cross-border claims against Chinese businesses had surged to $1.1 trillion, most of which was denominated in dollars, and more than $800 billion of which was owed to large Western banks. All told, 25% of China's corporate debts were in dollars, but only 8% of its corporate earnings. This mismatch was profitable but risky. If any one of the underlying conditions changed, interest rates, exchange rates, or commodity prices, then the position could become loss-making. In 2015, all three conditions changed. The Fed's retreat from QE promised that the interest margin would soon be shifting the wrong way. The slowdown in China's own growth and the sudden collapse in oil prices in 2014 reversed the momentum of commodity prices. Xi's drive against corruption in China caused wealthy families to move assets out of the country. The outflow exerted downward pressure on the yuan. For those holding some part of the $1.1 billion in foreign exposure, this combination of factors was very bad news, and due to the fact that this was common knowledge, it risked a stampede. Over the winter of 2015 to 2016, what threatened the world economy was, in the words of The Economist, nothing less than a calamity. The emerging market boom, which for so long had energized the narrative of globalization, had ground to a shuddering halt. Russia, Central Asia, Brazil, and South Africa were already in recession. An implosion of the Chinese economy, with a plunging yuan and investors scrambling for the exit, could easily have pushed the world economy into recession. The Economist painted a horror scenario in which the funds flowing out of China and a huge glut of overcapacity amplified a global cycle of deflation, the momentum of which would have been more unstoppable than in 2008. Industrial and commodity producers would be left insolvent. At the same time, if the yuan peg broke, it would not be the only currency to devalue. Dollar carry trades across the emerging markets would unravel, provoking a general financial crisis. Western banks would not be immune. The scenario was terrifying. Even the possibility of its unfolding was enough to spread panic. Commodity markets were intensely nervous. After falling off a cliff in November 2014, oil had stabilized in the spring of 2015 at around $60 per barrel. But China was now the world's largest crude importer. The prospect of a China crisis, coupled with the abundant supply of shale oil from the United States, and the intransigent stand of the Saudi government, sent markets over the edge once more. Between the summer of 2015 and January 2016, prices halved from $60 to $29 per barrel. As the Saudis no doubt intended, this dealt a painful blow to the heavily leveraged U.S. shale industry and sent ripples of anxiety through American financial markets. Even in the advanced economies, propped up by quantitative easing, deflationary pressures were looming. In January 2016, the question at Davos was not how China would lead, but how it would cope. Could Beijing prevent a collapse? Would a Chinese implosion turn the jarring reversal of the fortunes in the emerging markets into a comprehensive rout? A year on, this is the global crisis that the Trump administration did not inherit. The question is, why not? Any answer must start with the actions taken in Beijing. On the basis of its dramatic response to the crisis of 2008, the Chinese regime had a formidable reputation for effective economic policy. But in 2015, China's initial response to the crisis was anything but reassuring. The fumbling efforts to stabilize the Shanghai stock market exposed the myth of Beijing's omnicompetence. QE, with Chinese characteristics, was not a success. The August 2015 liberalization of foreign exchange trading was mishandled. But Beijing held its nerve. Rather than allowing the yuan to continue its slide, the PBOC stabilized a new peg. Capital controls were stiffened. But otherwise the PBOC allowed the unwinding of exposed dollar positions. If this was an adjustment of balance sheets, and not a general panic, it was the right thing to do. From their peak of $4 trillion in the summer of 2014, China's currency reserves fell by early 2017 to $3 trillion. Watching the monthly drain of tens of billions was nail-biting. but eventually at the lower level, reserves stabilized. To revive demand in early 2016, Beijing unleashed another credit boom and a fiscal stimulus, while at the same time it set about purging the most overexpanded heavy industrial sectors of overcapacity. Western media, ordinarily known for their advocacy of market freedom, could not hide their relief that Beijing's grip had been restored. As The Economist remarked, with capital now boxed in, much of it flowed into local property. House prices soared, first in the big cities and then beyond. Sales taxes on small cars were reduced by half. Between them, these controls and stimuli did the trick. In reaction, commodity prices rebounded and manufacturing surged across Asia, pulling China's giant manufacturing capacity back from the brink. The threat of global deflation receded. This is how the triumphalist narrative goes. China is not just another crisis-prone emerging market. Beijing is in control. A threat of crisis spawned in China that threatened to destabilize the world economy was contained by China. So far, so good, one might say. But 2015 demonstrated not only that China was neither invulnerable nor omnicompetent, even more significantly, it demonstrated that it was not autonomous. In 2008, the question had been whether China would dump its dollar holdings and destabilize the United States. 8 years later, thanks to China's deeper financial integration, the question was reversed. As Beijing struggled to gain a grip on its stock market and the drain of foreign exchange, the question was not whether China would dump the dollar, but whether the Fed would cooperate with China's efforts to stabilize the yuan. For Janet Yellen and the Fed board, it was a deep dilemma. The year 2015 started with the FOMC expecting to continue the process they had begun when they ended QE in December 2014. They were going to raise rates. The question was how far and how soon. After the taper tantrum of 2013, the Fed was acutely aware of the possible consequences for emerging markets. But with the American economy slowly moving toward full employment, they wanted to move off zero, if for no other reason than to give themselves room for maneuver when the next setback came. More generally, there was an insistent urge to normalize. Despite all the talk of secular stagnation, it was hard to accept that zero interest rates or the Fed's massively inflated balance sheet should be a permanent feature of the world economy. But now blocking the path to normalization was the threat of a China crisis. In 2013, the Fed had flaunted its exclusive focus on the state of the U.S. national economy. Could they take the same approach to China? Over the summer of 2015, the Fed prevaricated, but at the September FOMC meeting, the question could no longer be dodged. The majority of analysts expected the Fed to move rates up a notch. But then came the shock devaluation of the yuan, and the second slide in the Shanghai Stock Exchange. Whatever the limitations on the Fed's mandates, markets were global. They could not ignore the threat from China. On August 24th, America's Dow Jones lost 1,000 points, and the Fed pulled back. The normalization of U.S. monetary policy was put on hold, and Janet Yellen made no secret of the board's reasoning. Instability in China was the key. In the press conference on September 18, 2015, as she explained the FOMC's decision, journalists counted Yellen making 6 references to China and 10 to global factors. Unlike in 2013, when it had been India and Turkey under pressure, the risk of spillback from China to the United States was too important to be ignored. Indeed, the effect of Chinese deflation on the world economy was so powerful that there was no need for the Fed to pile on with its own interest rate increase. For Beijing, the Fed's forbearance came as a relief. The Chinese liked the idea of the Fed acknowledging interdependence. In October 2015, Finance Minister Lau Jiwei had the temerity to tell a meeting of the IMF that the Fed couldn't raise interest rates because China was on the line. The United States isn't at the point of raising interest rates yet, and under its global responsibilities, it can't raise rates, Lau said. The United States, he argued, should assume global responsibilities. because of the dollar's status as a global currency. In the United States, the reaction was more mixed. As troubled American market watchers immediately pointed out, Yellen's conditioning of U.S. policy on China enormously complicated the business of interpreting the Fed's next move. The markets had predicting the Fed down to a science. No one in the West was sure that they knew how to read Beijing. In December 2015, on the basis of America's own improving jobs market, the FOMC went ahead and raised rates. It was the first rate increase since 2006. Yellen's announcement made clear that the Fed intended to set a signal that the recovery had consolidated. But on both wings of American politics, it was hotly contested. Bernie Sanders' supporters rallied outside the New York Fed building demanding to know what recovery. Millions of Americans were still a long way from where they were in 2008. On the other hand, conservative opinion, eventually joined by Donald Trump, was irate that Yellen had not moved sooner. The message from the markets was similarly mixed. Initially, in December 2015, investors were relieved that the Fed had finally embarked on normalization. Then the uncertainty in China and the emerging markets and the collapse in oil prices came back to the fore. The year 2016 began with a major market sell-off. By mid-February, the S&P 500 had fallen by 11%. Once more, the Fed paused, a decision vindicated over the summer when markets reacted to Brexit with a spectacular sell-off, a fact too often overlooked by those struggling to understand Hillary Clinton's defeat in November 2016 is the sheer nervousness about the U.S. economy. 8 years on from 2008, the Sanders-Clinton-Trump contest was not set against the backdrop of a boom. So uncertain was the mood that the Fed did not consider it safe to raise rates until the end of the year, when the Trump bump was in full swing and the specter of global deflation had finally lifted. In 2015 to 2016, the world economy dodged a third installment of the global crisis. The emerging market recessions remained confined to individual economies, Russia, Brazil, South Africa, and particular commodities, notably oil. The downturn did not become generalized. It did not spread to the advanced economies. The slow recovery of the Eurozone, Britain, and the United States continued. Too easily forgotten, this fact should frame our understanding of the extraordinary political and geopolitical turmoil of the years since 2013. In the Ukraine crisis, the commodity price collapse even worked to the advantage of the West in multiplying the pressure of sanctions on Russia. Meanwhile, the Greek drama of 2015, Brexit, and Trump's election all took place against the backdrop of a nervous calm. We did not, in 2017, face the full force of Paulson's question, how would America and the world have fared if Trump at his inauguration had faced the kind of challenges facing Obama in 2009? But though crisis was avoided in 2015 to 2016, the stakes were going up. If we go back to the period before 2008, a China crisis had seemed in the cards then. But what worried observers was the possibility of a mass sell-off of dollar-denominated assets by China's reserve managers. As the storm clouds gathered, holding China in place was the first priority of Paulson's treasury. And Paulson was willing to pay a high political price for doing so. Brad Setzer's quip was to the point. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were too Chinese to fail. Nationalizing them helped to prevent a simultaneous Atlantic and Chinese crisis with consequences too awful to contemplate. But Paulson's financial diplomacy also highlights the fact that in 2008, managing Sino-American financial relations was still very much a matter of intergovernmental relations. By contrast, in 2015 to 2016, not only were the risks on the Chinese side, but the people moving the money were private businesses and investors. In less than 10 years, Chinese commercial and financial integration had come a staggeringly long way. Given the narrative unfolded in this book, this has daunting implications. This book has examined the struggle to contain the crisis in three interlocking zones of deep private financial integration: the transatlantic dollar-based financial system, the Eurozone, and the post-Soviet sphere of Eastern Europe. The challenges were immense. The implosion entangled both public and private finances in a doom loop. Bank failures forced scandalous government intervention to rescue private oligopolists. The Fed acted across borders to provide liquidity to banks in other countries. The crisis spilled over into a question of international relations, Germany and Greece, the UK and the Eurozone, the United States and the EU. And those questions were not posed in a power political vacuum, but in a geopolitical force field, graphically illustrated by the clashes with Russia over the destiny of Georgia and Ukraine. The challenges were mind-bogglingly technical and complex. They were vast in scale. They were fast-moving. Between 2007 and 2012, the pressure was relentless. In its own terms, as a capitalist stabilization effort, the response patched together by the US Treasury and the Fed was remarkably successful. Its aim was to restore the viability of the banks. It not only did that, but also provided massive liquidity and monetary stimulus to the entire dollar-based financial system, to Europe and the emerging markets beyond. All the more telling was the inability of the Democratic Party that carried the brunt of the effort to capitalize in political terms. In fact, TARP and the bailouts became dirty words, and the Fed suffered a spectacular loss of legitimacy. Overshadowed by memories of 2008, the 2016 election delivered a stark verdict. With Trump as president and the Republicans dominating Congress, it is an open question whether the American political system will support even basic institutions of globalization, let alone any adventurous crisis fighting at a national or global level. Faced with this American abdication, one might once have suggested that the euro area could provide an alternative. But the failure of the ECB, Germany, and France to devise a workable crisis-fighting strategy made the euro into a source of danger and instability for the world economy between 2010 and 2015. If it was saved, it was in large part due to outside pressure and assistance. Nor is it reassuring that the necessary measures were for a painfully long time resisted by Germany, the eurozone's most powerful member. Far from seeing Europe as a promising partner for global economic governance, Beijing and the rest of the G20 were repeatedly left wondering what on earth the Europeans were up to. The Germans might reply that they were teaching discipline, forcing Europe to prepare for a future of global competition. But what use was that if not only Greece, but Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Italy were overwhelmed by the immediate crisis? Finally, in 2012, what Monti politely referred to as the mental block was overcome. The ECB's newfound activism stabilized bond markets, but further progress on the essential financial underpinnings of banking union had been painfully slow, and Berlin still blocks the path to the issuance by Europe of a common safe asset, aka Eurobonds. As ever, the Franco-German axis is key. In 2017, the vote for Macron was a vote for Europe. Not for Europe as it stands, but for a new course. That depends on Germany. In May 2017, faced with the disaster of Trump's foreign policy, Merkel declaimed the need for Europe to forge its own path. But whether Berlin will be a partner for such a project after the German elections of 2017 is an open question. The rise of the AfD is ominous. It is now largely known as a racist anti-immigrant and refugee party, but it had its origins in 2013 in furious right-wing reaction to Draghi and the ECB. No less consequential for Europe is the end of the Grand Coalition, the role of the FDP in Merkel's handling of the Eurozone crisis in 2010 to 2012 was baneful, as was that of the right-wing CSU in Bavaria. At the time of writing, Europe waits for the formation of a new German government. The transatlantic relationship is not built on money alone, of course. It is meshed with deep cultural, political, diplomatic, and military relations. And those extended, or at least so it seemed, to Eastern Europe, which was so eagerly integrated into the EU and NATO in the early 2000s. In East Asia, America's alliance system was always more loosely knit. And the victory of the West in the Cold War was far from complete. China's economic triumph is a triumph for the Communist Party. This is still the fundamental reason for doubting the possibility of truly deep cooperation with China in global economic governance. Unlike South Korea, Japan, or Europe, China is not a subordinate part of the American global network. When the United States extended swap lines in 2008, it was acting in a zone that is both a depoliticized realm of economic activity and yet framed by a deep power relationship. The politics of Chinese foreign investment and suspicion of the role played by its state-owned enterprises suggest that deeply shared economic interests of the kind that legitimated the Fed's swap lines for Europe will be far harder to develop. And experience on the frontier of Western power in Eastern Europe hardly gives grounds for optimism about the ability of either Washington or the Europeans to conduct financial diplomacy in areas of real geopolitical tension. During the height of the crisis in 2008 to 2009, the West was, frankly, neglectful of Eastern Europe, despite the fact that talk of NATO expansion had led to a war with Russia in Georgia only weeks before the outbreak of the crisis in August 2008. In 2009, significantly, it was veterans of the George H.W. Bush administration who were warning that Eastern and Western Europe were once more at risk of dividing. Then, in 2013, the EU sleepwalked into confrontation with Putin over Ukraine. And all of this at a moment when the Obama administration was pushing TPP, seen in Beijing as aggressive containment, and Japan and China were confronting each other over rocky islands in the East China Sea. No doubt the Trump administration is unpredictable, but it was on Obama's watch, with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, that relations with Russia and China escalated to this degree. Russia survived sanctions because of its reserves. China's resources are far larger. Perhaps they are such that one does not need to envision a world of truly close cooperation between the Fed and the PBOC. But those Chinese reserves are the result of the system of financial regulation and exchange control that the West has for so long criticized. China's ability to stop the drain of its foreign exchange reserves involved a renewed tightening of those controls. In economic terms, it was only partially successful. And within China itself, it involves a power struggle between those parts of the elite whose primary concern is to get their wealth to safety and the regime managers struggling to preserve stability. Huge financial risks remain. As the great economist Abba Lerner once cuttingly remarked, economics has gained the title Queen of the Social Sciences by choosing solved political problems as its domain. The future of China's political economy and its relations with the West do not belong to that domain. The events of 2015 to 2016 in China recall another major theme of this book. Even to a regime as competent and well-informed as that of China, the economic setbacks came suddenly and unexpectedly. We have various words for this: panic, crisis, freeze, implosion, run, sudden arrest, sudden stop, radical uncertainty. And all these descriptions of what has happened or has threatened to happen to the global financial system since 2007 point to one thing: the fact that on top of the structural, slow-moving tensions that global integration may generate, it also produces sudden ruptures, events that cannot be fully accounted for or reduced to structural terms or regulated by law. These crises are hard to predict or define in advance. They are not anticipated and often deeply complex, and they are urgent. Such moments demand counteracting intervention. They demand action. It is this juxtaposition that frames the narrative of this book: large organizations, structures, and processes on the one hand, decision, debate, argument, and action on the other. One way to think of such moments is in terms of the metaphors of emergency or of firefighting. Among American crisis fighters, military vocabulary was commonplace: maximum force, the Powell Doctrine, shock and awe, big bazooka. But one might also say that what is called for is that intangible and volatile thing, political leadership and action. This depends on formulating plans and programs, rallying support, and fending off opposition. When the financial crisis escalated in the waning days of the Bush administration in 2008, doubts about American leadership were rife, and as far as the Republican Party was concerned, they were amply justified. At that critical moment, the Republican Party failed as the bracket between its mass base and the imperatives of systemic stabilization. It was that experience that Paulson saw reenacted in even more extreme form in 2016, in the disempowerment of the Republican elite and the selection of Trump as candidate. In 2008, the systemic interest in a bailout was obvious. It extended across the Atlantic. But in its political essentials, it took a fragile, cross-party coalition, assembled by elite Republicans and the Democratic Party leadership, to hold the United States together and provide the underpinnings for the global stabilization efforts of the Fed and the Treasury. America's subsequent political polarization and Trump's election in 2016 throw the historic significance of that coalition once more into stark relief. This is the American side of the drama. As such, it has global significance. But it has its counterparts everywhere touched by the crisis. In Europe and in Asia, too. The Eurozone crisis posed the question over and over again. How could coalitions be assembled for unpopular but essential actions? Whose will, stamina, endurance, interests, and willingness to compromise would prevail? It is shocking, perhaps, that this degree of indeterminacy should characterize one of the most vital pivots of the global order. But building such ad hoc and lopsided political coalitions is what the governance of capitalism under democratic conditions entails. In the 20th century, it was what made the difference between the Treaty of Versailles and the Marshall Plan, or Herbert Hoover's and FDR's responses to the Great Depression. The political in political economy demands to be taken seriously. Since 2007, the scale of the financial crisis has placed that relationship between democratic politics and the demands of capitalist governance under immense strain. Above all, this strain has manifested itself not in a crisis of popular participation or the ultimate control of policy by elected leaders, but in a crisis in the political parties that have historically mediated the two. It has tested their programs, their coherence, and their ability to mobilize support, and they have been found wanting. In many countries, this has swept away the moderate parties of the left, in Greece and France most notably. They paid the price for their inability to constructively counter the stresses of the Eurozone crisis. In the Bundestag election of 2017, both of the two main parties in Germany, widely seen as the country that came through the crisis least affected, slumped to historic lows in popularity. In the United States and Britain, it is the mainstream parties of the right that have suffered the critical fracture, with dramatic consequences in the form of Brexit and potentially even more far-reaching implications from the increasing incoherence of the Republicans in the United States. The GOP commands an impressive vote-winning organization, a take-no-prisoners media machine, deep fundraising resources. But to judge by the record of the last 10 years, it is incapable of legislating or cooperating effectively in government. Given the once fashionable view that we live in an age of post-democracy, or even post-politics, the significance of these strictly political developments comes as something of a surprise. By dint of their massive weight, complex social systems such as the financial markets and apparatuses like the modern state and the interstate system that it inhabits create a sense of solidity. They make us doubt whether they could possibly be amenable to political agency, decision, or debate. We suspect technocratic preemption and usurpation around every corner, and often with good reason. There are ways of describing the operations of these systems that void the presence of politics. But if a history such as this has any purpose, it is to reveal the poverty of such accounts. Political choice, ideology, and agency are everywhere across this narrative, with highly consequential results, not merely as disturbing factors, but as vital reactions to the huge volatility and contingency generated by the malfunctioning of the giant systems and machines and apparatuses of financial engineering. Success and failure, stability and crisis can indeed pivot on particular moments of choice. It is not for nothing that we refer to a Lehman moment. And there were others. Deauville, Cannes 2011, whatever it takes, not to mention the Brexit referendum or the jaw-dropping American election of November 2016. Back to the 1500s and the conjoined birth of capitalism and the modern state system, such moments of decision, contingency, choice, and attendant drama have been constitutive of our sense of modern history. Though that sense of history might temporarily have been in abeyance after 1989, it has returned with a bang. Such moments are the coordinates of memory and commemoration. They motivate action. After September 15, 2008, avoiding another Lehman became an E-Day fixe of crisis managers around the world. They make up the timeline of narration and history. They define anniversaries, triggering debate and re-examination. Given the turmoil of the early 20th century, the early 21st century is crowded with centennials. In 2014 came the biggest of them all, the centennial of 1914. Commemoration and discussion of the outbreak of World War I was attended with profound interest around the world. Historians recalled the Urtrauma of the 20th century, and they did so against the backdrop of conflict in Ukraine and East Asia that made the lessons of 1914 seem particularly pertinent. In a less literal way, 1914 may also be a good way for thinking about the kind of historical problem that the financial crisis of 2008 represents. There is a striking similarity between the questions we ask about 1914 and 2008. How does a great moderation end? How do huge risks build up that are little understood and barely controllable? How do great tectonic shifts in the global order unload in sudden earthquakes? How do the railway timetables of giant technical systems combine to create disaster? How do anachronistic and out-of-date frames of reference make it impossible for us to understand what is happening around us? Did we sleepwalk into crisis? Or were there dark forces pushing? Who is to blame for the ensuing human-induced, man-made disaster? Is the uneven and combined development of global capitalism the driver of all instability? How do the passions of popular politics shape elite decision-making? How do politicians exploit those passions? Is there any route to international and domestic order? Can we achieve perpetual stability and peace? Does law offer the answer? Or must we rely on the balance of terror and the judgment of technicians and generals? These are the questions that we have asked about 1914 for the last 100 years. It is not by accident that their analogues are also the questions we ask about 2008 and its aftermath. They are the questions that haunt the great crises of modernity. This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World, by Adam Tooze. This program was directed by Harry Nangle. Executive producer Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2018 by Adam Tooze. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.